Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome once more to yet another special bonus edition of the Paul Ryder Tapes, featuring the interviews in full that we did for the main series. And this week's episode features again someone who was instrumental in putting Madchester on the musical map. He was possibly the Mondays' very first champion who spotted their potential from the very start. He's a legendary DJ, successful author, music critic, and is Madchester through and through. He is the sire of Scribe, the titan of the turntable, the prince of pen, that is the legendary and the lovely Dave Haslam.
Well, the first time I heard about them, I was doing bits of work at the Hacienda DJing. I was often asked to DJ before bands played and then after. So the first EP around September of 85. But at that time, I hadn't met them and I didn't really know anything about them, although I was immediately into the music. I kind of naively thought they were going to be like every other band in Manchester. And it was only once I'd seen them play and met them that I kind of realised that they were a proper one-off maverick type gang and were nothing like all the other bands. I became like a, I guess what you call like a champion of them, you know. So at that point in 85 into 86, I had my fanzine. I was putting on bands at the Boardwalk with Nathan McGough. And I also had been asked by the NME to do bits of writing for them. So I was in a kind of position where if there was a band I really liked, I could push them. And I have to say that a lot of Manchester bands I was not that interested in, because they were, at that point, there were quite a lot of bands who sounded a bit like the Smiths, because obviously right. They were huge. A lot of bands sounded a bit like Echo and the Bunnymen. A few bands sounded like Joy Division. And the bands that they sounded like, they tended to dress like, let's say, students. Obviously, the Smiths weren't students, but a lot of those bands kind of dressed a bit like you'd imagine the Smiths did. So I started going to see the Mondays play after being introduced to the music on the first record. And that's when I realised that Casual, Perry Boy, whatever, that look, no other band was sporting that. That was a different look. When the first album came out, I persuaded the NME that I should do the review. And the way these things work is, bands at that point, they need people to knock on doors for them. Because at Factory, there's no big PR machine, there's no marketing. Everything used to happen very much on a kind of whatever whim Tony Wilson wanted. So I remember asking if I could review the album, and I managed to get a pretty good amount of space, a third of a page or something, and I waxed lyrical about the album. But I'd still never had a conversation with them. Anyway, eventually, the Enemy also said to me, well, why don't you write a piece about some of these bands you're talking about? And I honestly don't think the Mondays had ever been interviewed before, certainly not by a national music paper. So when it would have been around the middle of 1986. In fact, I remember the NME and me having a conversation about the Mondays. And I said, I honestly don't think it'll be like a serious interview. I had the feeling from seeing them wandering around and playing that they weren't, again, going to be like the other bands who were going to be talking about vegetarianism or Thatcher. I thought the conversation would be a bit more freestyle, shall we say. And I made a little note to myself before I went to the interview, not too serious, because I was quite a serious man, serious young lad. And I thought, I've got to approach this in a little bit more. Yeah, so got the bus up to Cheetham Hill. I think this was before the first album, yeah, the middle of 86. Leicester Avenue, Cheetham Hill. I'm not sure whose flat that was. And because at that point, there's no research. You can't go on Google and find anything out. And you can't, there were no other interviews to go by. So I had no idea. I didn't even know really who was who. And I arrived and there were about five or six people in the room. And I thought, well, that's okay. That's the band. Because I knew there were five or six people in the band because Bez was at that point sort of in and out of the band. So but it turned out, I think, only two or maximum three of the lads in the room were actually in Happy Mondays. And the others were just part of the gang. They were just hanging out for the afternoon. And to be honest, that kind of set the scene for the Mondays forever. There was always a gang with them. So only basically half the band had turned up. And they couldn't have been less bothered about helping me write something interesting about the band.
Which band members were there?
Honestly, I don't know. Sean wasn't there because at one point I remember saying, looking around the room, desperately trying to work out what was going on, who's the singer? And they're like, oh, he's not here. So I think Sean and Bez were definitely not there. Not every band had a lot to say, but most bands would be, okay, the NME guy has come to interview us. Let's at least all turn up, number one. And number two, let's say stuff that is interesting so that we come across well. They're unknown. At that point, they were literally, they could have done a free gig in the middle of Manchester and nobody would have gone to see them. So they needed this. But like I say, they weren't bothered. And I gave up, to be honest. I gave up and I came away with nothing worth talking about. And so what I did was I went into town. The manager, Phil Sachs, had a stall in Arndale Market. So I went to Phil and I said, look, I've done my best with your lads, but there's nothing. And Phil, he was like saying stuff like, they're the new Velvet Underground. Which is like exactly, that's what you want, because then you write that in the NME and then the headline piece, the new Velvet Underground, and that'll help sell records. So he knew the game, but they were so not interested in the game.
Was that just naivety on their part, do you think? Or did they genuinely not give a damn about what happened? Because they did want to be... They wanted to be successful, so I don't understand why they didn't see how important potentially that could have been.
I think they genuinely didn't really know how the music business really operated. And I think Phil Sachs had a great relationship with them. I think he was probably a bit too relaxed with them. I think that he probably... Right. Another manager would have been there and made sure it was just a few hundred words, really. I think I probably said something along the lines of what I was thinking at that time, which is that the generation of bands after the Smiths are going to be like, this is something different. You need to get used to it. And I felt like I was going out on a limb. The following year, they did a gig at Platt Fields in Manchester. And it was free. And there were hardly anyone there. And definitely by this time, the first album had come out. So you'd had an album, you'd had a single, they're on Factory, they played with New Order. There was a free gig in Platt Fields and 150 people. And again, I was like to the enemy, let me review them, let me review. So I did the live review. I remember it was brilliant. I mean, when you're reviewing a band, you kind of look very closely at trying to work out how it's happening and the mechanics of it all and the vibe. And what I loved about them at that period, and it didn't really change, was how it did feel like it was all going to fall apart, or it could all fall apart at any minute. And that was something that was attractive to me, because I was old enough to go to gigs in the late 70s where, say, Iggy Pop would play, or Buzzcocks would play, or even Joy Division, you know, who I saw play a few times. And you had got the same feeling from them. And I didn't want Simply Red-style slick musicianship and everyone choreographed. And I liked the edge that gave them. But to me, that kind of sense that it could fall apart was what made them, you couldn't take your eyes off them for that reason. The weird thing I always thought about Sean was how I think he wasn't a natural frontman. I think he felt he got stage fright. I don't think he wanted to be Iggy, you know? And I don't think none of the band were, I would have said, performers. We turn up, we do our thing. So having Bez there was a focal point. I remember it was the first time they played 24-Hour Party People, was at that gig. And that was, August 1987. And I remember in the review, I said, new song, 24-Hour Party People. I don't know if this is a rallying cry or not, but if it is, jump on board. Morrissey would not have written a song called 24-Hour Party People. In my attempt to analyse them, that was where I was positioning them against what was generally around on the indie scene. Bands like The Wedding Present and all these other bands that were getting a lot of press, they wouldn't have written a song called 24-Hour Party People. But and also by that time, Nathan had become their manager. So I got a little bit closer to the band at that time.
Do you remember the characters that you were interacting with in the band at that point? Do you remember when they started to show their personalities to you?
Yeah, that was more when Nathan and I began working together at the beginning of 1986. He was managing a factory band called Kalima and a band called the Bodines, who were signed to Creation Records, who were quite hip at that time. And we started working together, putting bands on, and then we started putting out records. So we had a little office in town. And then I remember the time when the time came for them to leave Phil Sachs and for Nathan to become their manager. And that, I think that I remember that as being a little bit traumatic. Phil seemed to be like a bit of a father figure to them all, and they really looked up to him and he believed in them. But Nathan was a good friend of Tony Wilson. In a way, Tony was a bit of a father figure to him. And Tony always had this thing, never to deal with a band who haven't got a manager. He wouldn't talk, he didn't want to deal with the drummer. I remember Wilson used to go, I can't sign that band, I'd have to deal with the drummer. And he knew that would be a disaster. So, no offence, Gaz Whelan. So having Nathan, who Wilson really trusted, come on board. And I think because they rehearsed at the Boardwalk and me and Nathan put on bands at the Boardwalk, and they knew the Bodines and Kalima Factory, Nathan was a good fit. And also Nathan had that ability, and he was quite happy to stay up all night. He was quite happy to not put anything in the diary for the mornings. He knew what the Monday's lifestyle was like. And so he was probably, I think, the only person around at that time who could navigate Happy Mondays where they needed to go, because he was enough like them. So anyway, so me and Nathan had an office in town, and so the band started coming in, basically. So that was the first time, apart from the disastrous interview, that I'd met any of them in the cold light of day. I remember my main thing used to be to try and work out who were the flakiest. Because Nathan was often not there, so I'd have to, they'd come in and they'd want to know where the gig was or who'd booked the van or can we have some cash. I do remember Paul was definitely not in the top three flakiest. Somebody met Sean the other day and said they were a friend of mine, and he said, I don't think I've ever met Dave. I actually interviewed him for a TV show, and he used to walk into the office all the time. So he was in the top three flakiest. I was DJing at the Hacienda on a Thursday and a Saturday, and they would come in on a Thursday particularly because I was the only DJ at the Hacienda who played any of their records. I think they felt at home on at the Hacienda on any night, but I think on a Thursday musically worked best for them. And that's when I got to know all the characters, basically.
What kind of impression did Paul give you?
Well, what Paul was very un-rock and roll starish. Paul came across quite self-effacing, quite cool about stuff. He never kicked off about anything. Because it's a high-pressured environment. You're a young band, you've got no money. The record label's got no money. Your manager's got no money. Someone's got to get you down to London. Stuff happens. Who are we going to blame? So having him in the band was, I think, probably gave the band a little bit of an anchor, a bit of a ballast. So it didn't have to be chaos every day. I think musically, compared to some of the indie bands, Andy Raut was a great bass player for the Smiths, so I'm not talking about them, but some of the other indie bands that were around, they had no sense of rhythm. It would be just like bang, 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 bang. But to have that funkiness was, I think, very important to their sound. And they had that, obviously. There's this idea that all the white boys in Manchester had no rhythm or no inclination to dance until Ecstasy arrived, and then suddenly all the white boys danced. But that wasn't my memory of that period at all. I remember lots of white kids into funk, into soul, into reggae. Paul was definitely had that eclectic music sense, which was, again, an important way of the band standing out.
But then Ecstasy did come along and dance music infiltrated the Mondays sound. Do you feel like they did a huge turn? Did they turn 90 degrees when the dance grooves came along?
My memory of, generally, of Manchester and the scene and what was happening at the Hacienda was that there was an evolution in what people were listening to musically before Ecstasy. For example, bands like Trouble Funk were huge at the Hacienda. And they were like, they were dance bands. They didn't even have verse, chorus, verse, chorus. It'd be just like, drop the bomb. And then the bass line would come in. And like all the hip hop stuff and all the sampled stuff. And all that was big in at the Hacienda, all through the history of the Hacienda. But 85, 86, 87, Love Can't Turn Around, Jack Your Body, those records came out before Ecstasy. So I think that was already infiltrating the culture, if you like. And I think the Mondays already had a kind of, yeah, like I say, had a funkiness. I think what Ecstasy did was it actually probably gave them an audience.
Right. Oh, that's interesting.
Rather than a new way of making music. I think that loosened up maybe some of the audience to think, okay, I can relate to what is happening on stage, or I can relate to the records more. If you're talking about how music evolves and cult bands and scenes, it's not always about the music. It's often about how people look. And the drug. Every generation has the drug, which the end of the 1960s, LSD, when acid arrived, it changed the music, but it also changed the audience. It changed the whole ambience of the world for youth culture anyway. So I think when ecstasy came along, it was like the final piece in the jigsaw. That is the moment when Tony Wilson really understood them, because Tony was always talking about creating a revolution. He wanted to create something like punk. His big hero was Malcolm McLaren. He knew that music could be the vehicle to knock the world off its axis. And the Mondays were that for him. And so the drug was part of, because Wilson had grown up in the end of the 60s when he was a student, he knew how important that new drug was to crystallising the new moment. So when that came along, the Mondays and their crew were pretty much the earliest into ecstasy of the whole Hacienda crowd. It was like Happy Mondays Corner at the Hacienda, underneath the balcony. That's where they and their crew hung out. But by, I would say, February or March 88, ecstasy was pretty prevalent at the Hacienda. And so it was over that summer that the whole Madchester thing happened, and Rave On, and the remixes, the Rope for Luck remixes, the Vince Clarke remix of Rope for Luck. I think that really opened up people's ears to the Mondays. So ecstasy was definitely an important part of that, but I don't think necessarily for the sound they were making, but it changed the context that they were working in to their advantage.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
An important part of their career was the Rope for Luck video. I remember that moment and it all being filmed, and my friend Philip Shotton, who filmed that, the Bailey brothers. What that video did, which was filmed at Legend, when it's just like strobing and it's like an acid house club. The thing with that was, in a world where information about music and everything else was not as accessible as it is now, the chart show and Snub TV and other TV shows were a really important thing for people, important way for people to access new music. But obviously with the Mondays, it was also the look. So it was like, for so many people, a glimpse into kind of like a subculture. So them as subculture heroes, that came about through that video. Because there would be kids looking for something a bit different, age whatever, 15, 16, on a Saturday watching the chart show. And that video would have just stood out a mile. And in fact, Philip remembers that he showed it to Tony Wilson and Rob Gretton, who was New Order's manager and part of the Factory Brigade. And yeah, Tony was like eulogising about how great it was in his flamboyant style. And Rob said to Phil, two words, Sex Pistols. because for him it was it had the potential to do what Thatcher had always wanted to do, which was to create the Sex Pistols for a new generation, not musically, but just in terms of what it could, what that band could achieve. It was the same as in the early 60s when Ready Steady Go was on. The kids would watch Ready Steady Go and they'd see James Brown doing Uptight. And the next day they'd all go out and they'd buy Black American Soul records and they'd all dress like mods. It was both of the moment and creating the moment.
Do you feel like Tony's prophecy came about? Do you feel like they did have that success and that legacy that Tony was aspiring for them to have?
Good question. I mean, without them, Manchester would not have happened. They lent cool to the Stone Roses. I don't think the Stone Roses would have happened in quite the same way if they hadn't partnered up in a way in the public consciousness with the Mondays. And they certainly changed the way people dressed. I think they changed, at least for indie culture, that Loose Fit, which was always one of my favourite Mondays records, that kind of looseness came into music generally in a way which previously hadn't been. Kids transitioned from listening to guitar-based music to listening to dance music, and the New Order, to be fair, was part of the transition, but I think the Mondays, for that generation, took people into whole areas of music they would not have otherwise listened to. Record companies were actually a little bit scared of what the Mondays could do because they came across to people as like kids off the estate, which again was part of punk, Vicious, Johnny Rotten. And I'm not sure whether the record industry likes that particularly because it's not controllable. They like controllable acts. So I think there was a limit to what they could achieve because of just the conservative nature of the music industry.
There was a time Paul talked about somebody from a major label, can't remember which the label was, that came to see them before they were signed to Factory, and they came to see them rehearsing in a school hall, and while they were rehearsing or playing for the record company, someone started throwing bricks through the window. And so the record company, and the record company said, oh, you don't have an image, you don't have a look. If that hadn't happened, if the bricks hadn't come through the window and the record company had got over the fact that they didn't feel like they had a look, and if they'd signed to a major label, how different do you think the trajectory would have been?
I think it would have fallen apart quite quickly. I can't imagine that Wrote for Luck moment happening, for example. A major company record company wouldn't have put out a video like that. And also I think that although the record industry likes to ride on the back of rock and roll misbehaviour, in the same way as when Oasis started, two-thirds of the coverage of Oasis was about these two brothers who fight all the time. They like to trade off the back of that, but I don't think record companies can deal with heavy drug use and only two out of the band turning up for interviews. There was a time when the band were interviewed at Dry Bar by a journalist called Stephen Wells, and the band was messing around a bit, and I think they were probably a bit intoxicated or whatever. And Stephen Wells was quite a kind of politically aware young guy from London. And I think they made a few remarks which, in the cold light of day, appeared homophobic and not very right on. And it was printed in the NME. And it was the kind of thing that other bands, it would have been a backlash against them, because whatever they said wasn't progressive or particularly good. It was daft stuff. But Wilson said, all publicity is good publicity. He was really happy to indulge that kind of carry-on. They dug themselves out of that. I feel like they never made the album I think they could have made. excitement and edge and imaginative, riotous nonsense of one of their live gigs never transferred into a whole album, in my opinion, which is frustrates me because I like that's what bands are judged by, ultimately. So I think with my rock critic head on, that's what I would say. The only other time I interviewed them was I interviewed Sean on his own. It was for Snub TV, which was quite an influential TV show back then. I think this must have been about 89. And I turned up at the appointed time and he was asleep and eventually woke up, sat me down on the sofa, and then he vomited for about 15 minutes, which is all on tape. If any factory collector wants to buy the Sean Ryder vomits in Granby Road tape off me, it's available. Yeah, then we did a bit of an interview, but it was, hard work for different reasons. There was a lot of chaos and there was a lot of bad drugs. No one wins, really, in that situation.
Do you think that the bad drugs are the reason why they didn't go on to produce more and more brilliant albums? Do you think that kind of was the death of them, or do you feel like without that they wouldn't have been what they were?
I think probably without drugs, I'm not saying bad drugs, but generally without drugs, they probably would. Obviously, they'd probably made a different kind of music from the start. Once heroin was knocking around, there's no going back, really. I think certainly the making of Yes Please is, it's talked about all the time and it's turned into kind of like a funny story and a kind of glamorised, you know, they came back, hadn't not recorded any lyrics or vocals. But that's a career down the pan. But also, of course, the context of making that album was Wilson and Factory were struggling as well. So in terms of there being a stable base to anything that was happening, that had all gone. Because again, working with Nathan, I remember all the phone calls and the what we're going to do and this isn't happening. And literally, Factory going bankrupt. And if we can't get this album out, it's all over. And New Order had already gone on strike, more or less. And we're like, we're not doing another album to save the label. It was crumbling away, wasn't it?
So what would you say the legacy is of the Monday? How would you describe the legacy?
I think, in a sense, the legacy is giving hope to bands that they can just express themselves in an authentic way, dress in an authentic way, live the life they want to lead, and there's a place for them in the music industry. I can't even point to bands that have attempted, let alone achieved, any kind of musical inspiration from them, because that's almost impossible. It's like the most un-Mondays thing you could do is to sound like the Mondays. But I think that the attitude is certainly something that lots of bands have aspired to, left, right and centre. The other great thing is how they translated their own view of the world, and people all around the world bought into it. I've been lucky enough to DJ a lot around the world. And I remember one time I DJed in Peru and I arrived at the venue and a queue of people waiting to get in the venue, some of them wearing Happy Mondays t-shirts. And I'm like, how does some kid in Peru understand anything about the Mondays? And yet they did, because there was something very unique and magical about the music.
Do you have any memories of a playing the record when you were a DJ and being blown away by the response that it got?
Sometimes I forget how good some of those records are. But because I feel like I've heard those records so much, I sometimes don't play them as often as I could. Relatively recently, I was DJing in Paris, and I played Hallelujah, and it just sounded so fantastic. But yeah, the reaction was really positive.
How did you feel when you found out that Paul had died?
The first thing I did was I messaged my pal Cressa, because I know he was close to the Mondays from the start. We were a proper community in the 80s. I think people are under the impression that my generation and Paul's, that one day we woke up and everybody was talking about Manchester. The saying is it takes years of hard work to become an overnight success. And by the time the Mondays were on Top of the Pops, all the things I've talked about, that's like November 1989. That's like 4 years on from the first single. And in that period, it felt like a collective effort. So I think when Paul died, it was like, wow, our crowd. He was so important in our crowd, our extended family. That's like a tragedy and an eye-opener, really.
Yeah. It's a leveller, isn't it? It makes us aware of our own mortality as well, but...
Yeah.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How do you feel that the Mondays will evolve now? Like, do you feel like it's the end for them?
There's no reason why they can't go on and do their shows. The joke is always about groups like the Four Tops, who obviously their heyday was 50 years ago. And they go on tour, and no one's ever sure how many of the Four Tops are in the Four Tops. But people will still go and see them because the music's so good. That's just our generation's version of, you know, the Four Tops on tour with the Drifters. Who knows?
Really, really appreciate you giving your time.
Right, lovely. Okay.
Yeah, thank you so much. Really nice to meet you. And I hopefully we'll meet in the flesh at some point.
Yeah. Brilliant. Okay, yeah. Nice
All
one.
All right, nice one, Dave. Thank you.
See you.
Take care.
That's all we've got for you this week. We are big arming it up again this week with everyone's favourite track from the album Radiator, Sun Rays, coming up in a second. We'll be back again next week, same time, same place, with another episode. And if you'd like to watch the video version of this episode, it's going to be premiering next Sunday, that is April the 28th, on YouTube at 8 p.m. UK time. Please do me a favour and hit the subscribe button so you'll be the first to hear about all the new content. And please join our Patrons Club by going to patreon.com/ The Paul Ryder Tapes. Patrons get first dibs on being in our Zoom meetings with some of our guests so that you get the opportunity to ask your questions directly. And we've got quite a few in the pipeline, so don't miss out. Check out the website at paulryder.tv for links to the socials and our shop. Have a brilliant week, everyone. Hiya to everyone in the Sunday Club. Yay, you know who you are. Big thanks to all of you for being here. Special thanks, obviously, goes to the absolute legend that is Dave Haslam. And, of course, big thanks, as usual, and love to the man himself inspiring all of this. And he would have been 60 this week. It was his birthday on the 24th of April. So happy 60th birthday up in heaven to the late, great Paul Anthony Ryder.
Suitcase full of dough, not sure where to go. It's gonna be hot, that's all I know. Got a long, long way to go with my case full of dough. Where I'll stop, I do not know.
Listening Productions.